Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Canadian historian Craig Herron's talk, the second in six lectures of the History Matters lecture series sponsored by the Toronto Public Library. Herron's talk, entitled "I'll Drink to That, Booze in Hogtown," discusses a number of fascinating aspects in the social history of alcohol in Toronto from his 2003 book, Booze, A Distilled History. Please check back on ActiveHistory.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the History Matters lecture series.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, to see so many familiar faces and some new ones. I'm very grateful to the Toronto Public Library for inviting me, for the Annette Library for making this, the staff here for making this available and possible, setting it all up for us, for Lisa for having drawn me into it, and for all of you who've turned out on a rotten night to talk about what's often one of the favorite subject that people have when they get together. When I was working on that book, one of the worst things I could do when I was out walking the dog in the park was to tell people what I was writing. Because I'd lose an extra 45 minutes before I got home, because everybody seemed to want to talk about booze and to tell me their stories. And as I listened, I realized that actually struck a pretty important vein in Canadian life. In fact, as that continued when the book came out, I realized I should have planned a second book right away called Booze Tales. I'm not joking, I really should have, because everybody had stories, and there is a kind of way of talking about drinking that's, I think, particularly Canadian. We can talk about that later. But anyway, I hope that I'm not going to talk too long so that you can also share your stories and ask your questions, and that this can be an interesting exchange. There's a lot to cover, and I'm not going to try and do it all. That's just, well, kind of once over lightly. Maybe I should say that if you're sitting too far around the side, you're going to have trouble seeing the screen. There's still two empty seats in the front. We could squeeze another chair in here, but that column is a real problem.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah, you guys might want to sit over there.
Okay. This always happens in meetings, people. Please move up to the front. All of us who teach at York have to do this all the time. So I want to take you back, first of all, to colonial times. The focus of the book was on Canada more broadly, but tonight I want to try and focus in on Toronto to some extent and take you back to everyday life in colonial Upper Canada. The short part of this story is that booze was everywhere. Everywhere you turned, you were encountering it. And I'm going to pause for a second and let everybody get seated. There are two empty chairs right in the front, right here. And if two people move apart here, we could squeeze an extra one in over there. One over here. And if anyone's back over there and can't see, there's a seat right in the front here. Okay, back to Upper Canada. If you got up in the morning, the chances are pretty good you saw your father taking his first shot because he needed a tonic. The chances are pretty good that you'd see it on the dinner table of some form or other. The chances are pretty good that if you got sick or anyone else in the family got sick, that booze would come out of the cupboard to help you get over it. Various versions of booze, obviously. People drank it as a beverage at meals. People took it as a tonic and as a medicine. They also drank it on the job. That's the hardest thing for most people to get used to today. We take coffee breaks, but the idea that people would stop work at 11 in the morning and at 4 in the afternoon to have a shot of rum, which they regularly did, is still something we have a hard time getting our minds around. It's also true that people who worked as farmers' laborers would expect a pail of beer in the field during the day to keep them going during the hard summer, under the hard summer heat. People also drank, of course, in public celebrations of all kinds. Many people drank too much, no question. Especially on binges at the end of long bouts of work, whether they were coming in from the woods after logging or coming off ships in port or farming bees and so on. Various ways in which you ended the bout of work. Miriam, I think there's still more chairs through there if people want to bring them through. But the interesting thing is, as I think this tippling picture that Cornelius Krieghoff was able to suggest is that there's no question this character has had too much to drink, but we're not meant to despise him or in any way disparage him. We just feel a bit sorry for his lack of willpower. And that's more or less how people thought. And they didn't weren't concerned as much about this as they were with this. You know, in other words, his willpower. And then on the whole, I think drunkenness was tolerated to a degree that would not be, we wouldn't see again until late in the 20th century. There's another element of drinking in these early years that's important to emphasize, and that this picture helps us to appreciate. Obviously, what these gentlemen are drinking, in this case, it's probably port, because aristocratic gentlemen drank gallons of port. In Britain, in this early period, they probably drank 7 bottles each at a single sitting. At any rate, the important thing is that what they're drinking is the lubricant of this social situation. It's what's drawing them together. People like to gather together around alcoholic drinks as a central part of the process of socializing and building bonds amongst themselves. But note, there are no women in this picture. That should not be so surprising, since for the most part, the most important bond that was being built around alcohol was a masculine identity. This, by the way, is not just true of colonial Upper Canada. It was true throughout the world that men used alcohol as a way of bonding around their particular masculine identities. Here, it wasn't just aristocrats. It could be men in craft workshops, or men working for the Hudson's Bay Company, or men digging canals, or men in the military. Any group of workers or producers who used booze to unite around their different masculinities. And what they shared was the sense that women were not normally part of that experience. And that would last well into the 20th century, as we'll see as I progress. That's not to say that women didn't drink in colonial times. They certainly drank at home to some limited extent. They sometimes appeared in taverns, although usually only on the arm of their menfolk. But what's different is they didn't get up in the morning and say, oh, I've got to face the laundry. Whereas a man who's heading off to the fields probably did say, I've got to face the crops today, and off he'd go. Right? And I think that the way in which alcohol was integrated into to male work was quite different from the much more limited way that women participated in drinking. Where did people get the booze that they drank? Well, lots of it, as I've probably hinted at, was made at home, especially in Upper Canada, where farmers had so much surplus wheat that a lot of it was turned into whiskey. Right through the early 20th century, cookbooks had recipes for beer and wine. Mrs. Clark's Cookery of 1883, produced here in Toronto for the ladies of Toronto the Good, had recipes for beer, recipes for lemon wine, another grape wine, apricot wine, Danson wine, gooseberry wine, another gooseberry wine, ginger wine, and 5 more pages of wine recipes. Plus, when you flip through to the end, a lot of these recipe books had home remedies to cure things, alcohol all over the place in those medicinal cures. Well, production of alcohol got more commercial once there were enough settlers to buy it, obviously. Breweries began to appear in many communities throughout the colonies, and Toronto had many in the 19th century. Halliwell's Dawn Brewery, where Todd Morton Mills is now. Dole's Brewery at what is now Queen and Adelaide. Like many others, these were both small and had been closed by 1850. But in the second half of the century, much bigger breweries appeared, producing both kegs of beer, of course, and the collector's favorites, bottles of beer, both of which were for a growing urban market. And that included the Dawn Brewery, which lasted from the middle of the 19th century for 6 decades till 1907. I believe it's now condos. The Dominion Brewery, which lasted from the 1870s to the 1930s and still survives in as a mixture of condos in a very fancy pub. And of course, probably Toronto's most famous brewery, the O'Keefe Brewery at Victoria and Gould, that lasted for a century, the largest and the longest running. There were a number of others. Cosgrave's at Queen and Niagara, Reinhardt on River Street, Copland's on Parliament and King, and so on, all of which stretched into the 20th century, all of which, of course, are gone. In passing, you won't hear me say much more of anything about wine, because wine is never a significant industry in this country, in this part of the country in particular, until the last half of the 20th century, and really not until the last 30 years. We grew the wrong kind of grapes, we didn't know what to do with them anyway, and most wine drinkers drank imported wine, which was an elite drink and too expensive for most drinkers. But Toronto did have a liquor industry. Indeed, we had one of the major suppliers. Goodrem and Wirtz, which I'm sure you're all quite familiar with, thanks to the distillery district, dating all the way back to the 1830s. By 1861, its new plant was state of the art in the British, in the Western world, and reputedly the biggest in the British Empire. It was a major presence on the Toronto waterfront. And remember that in those days, the waterfront lapped at the front door of the distillery district. Now stand there and look out at how far the harbor has gone from there. Later, of course, it was connected to rail lines to make it possible to keep going, to send its products far and wide. And its reputation was very widespread. What we fail to often appreciate is the extent to which this was, in many ways, gold. Government revenues in the 19th century relied very heavily on excise taxes on alcohol. And consequently, since the most important alcohol was spirits, in every distillery there would be a government excise officer like this, who's having his formal picture taken, who would be testing to make sure that it was good quality stuff, because government revenues were so important, they didn't want to lose the taxes on this stuff, and they wanted to make sure that it was very good. And if you stop and think, I mean, it's amusing, but stop and think about it. We often think of income tax starting in the First World War, you know, this is a temporary measure, and for many years it didn't affect most working people because there was a $1,000 exemption. But in actual fact, working people, through their drinking habits, were subsidizing the Canadian state long before that. Because the tax that was put on spirits and particularly on spirits, but also on beer. Well, all this booze could be consumed at home, but a great deal more of it went down dry throats in taverns. In the earliest days of settlement, every village had a tavern. Often it was the first building to go up. It was used as a kind of community center for all sorts of activities, town meetings, court hearings, circuses, performances, guy would set up a barber shop in there sometimes, a huge variety of things went on. Also, of course, as way stations for travelers along on Upper Canada's dreadful roads. This is actually one way out on the Talbot Road, not here in Toronto. The Campbell's Inn, I think it's called. Initially, they could be quite rough, but innkeepers generally built something much more substantial that could be quite pleasant spots to meet friends or hold meetings. This is, of course, the Red Lion, just up in Yorkville. Meet friends or hold meetings. Well, meetings could be quite political, and by the time of the famous rebellions of 1837, they were a major focus of opposition to the old colonial regime. And in fact, Montgomery's Tavern, a bit further up Yonge Street, was one of the major battles fought out in 1837, where the rebels and the Loyalists squared off. And after the defeat of the rebels, the government Tories made sure that the place was burned down properly to make sure that no one ever tried to use it that way again. Over the course of the 19th century, taverns, for the most part, came to be attached to hotels, some of which we are still quite familiar with, of course. The Wheat Sheaf, which likes to date itself from 1849. Can we ever forget the Brunswick House? Which likes to date itself in 1876. The Dominion Hotel at Queen and Sumac dates from 1889, which is actually close to what I showed you a few minutes ago, the Dominion Brewery. And this lovely old building, which has lost its beautiful tower, this was taken before the Second World War. This is the Hayden House at St. Clair and Weston Road. It still exists, but folks out at this end of the city will know that it's in pretty derelict condition. This is how wonderful it used to once look. So these were places that were hotels, but the main feature on the ground floor was the drinking place. And there were so many more of them. To go through a city directory in the 19th century in Toronto was just to see at almost every street corner there's a small hotel. And that was the nature of hotel life in the city. Places that people actually stayed into as well. People traveling through the city, traveling salesmen, all sorts of people who need temporary accommodation, plus people who were single and needed a place to stay for any length of time. But down there on the first floor was a room set aside for drinking, sometimes called the bar room, but in popular discourse, they became known as the saloon. They were, by the end of the 19th century, pretty fancy places. This is the St. Charles Hotel. I honestly don't know if this is the same St. Charles, the one I'm going to show you later, that was on Yonge Street. I wasn't able to find out. But the important thing about this is to show just how ornate they had become. Mahogany bars, beautiful glassware and mirrors, lots of ornate woodwork, a great deal of which was either made available cheaply or directly supplied by the breweries who were supplying the drink. These were modeled to a great extent on the gin palaces in Great Britain that appeared in the middle of the 19th century, and the basic look of trying to make them look super elegant, even though people, as I'll say in a moment, were wandering in kind of in a grubby state. These places were also known loosely, and in fact, social historians increasingly use the label of working men's clubs, largely because male wage earners became the main clientele. Richer folk who used to hang out in the taverns in 1810 or 1820 had withdrawn into their own clubs or into their own private homes to sip their various drinks or not to drink at all, but they had left behind spaces that were overwhelmingly occupied by working men. And there these guys sought out some refuge from soul-destroying jobs, nagging mothers or wives, and other voices of responsibility. They also, however, got some practical concerns met. Food was usually available. In fact, some of these places offered free lunches, which is, of course, where our phrase comes from, there is no free lunch. Well, in fact, when you came in to drink, across North America, many urban saloons had a free lunch on the side of the floor. And of course, it wasn't really free because you were supposed to drink. You could get a bed if you needed a place to stay. You could get news about jobs from your foreman, or perhaps you could pay him a little money to get a better job. Or you could hear grievances discussed among your workmates, maybe that ultimately lead to you walking out on strike. Any number of things are going on in there. Heated discussions about local sports teams and gossip of all kinds. It was a male emporium of chatter. To build bonds amongst drinkers, of course, treating was a crucial ritual. Buying each other drinks was a way of bonding, as I'm sure these guys must have been doing. The whole place had a very masculine atmosphere. These pictures have no women in them. Women rarely were ever seen in these places, if at all. You would walk in and find shouting, laughing, swearing, smoking, spitting, bragging, storytelling. The place would smell of smoke, of stale beer, of bodies, of flatulence, and perhaps of one other thing. I've gotten into a great deal of hot water over this because I said it in the book, but I will repeat it for your benefit. I remember doing a breakfast television interview where they were just horrified at 8 in the morning to hear this. There's a woman in the United States who's written a book about working men's saloons and has done a lot of work on the architecture of them, which is almost identical to what happened here, same style. She said one of the things that happened in a male-only environment was not all men wanted to go down to a washroom. So some bars, some taverns, some saloons had a trough. It's just a picture. I'm just suggesting it's a possibility. It could have been, as she called them, a urination trough. This is not a particularly good, dowdy place on Yonge Street, the Vendôme Hotel. Perhaps it's not possible, but in most other places you don't see the trough, and you see spittoons all over the place. So maybe that's just for spitting in. In either case, it's a particularly unpleasant place. Saloons were also a place for singing and where popular music tended to spread around, some of which was transferred into popular sheet music and later recorded. When I was writing the book, I went to the Toronto Public Library, it's appropriate they're sponsoring this lecture, to see if they had any drinking songs in their sheet music collection, which is enormous. They have thousands of them. This is the only one they have. Give me a song that's gay, written by a guy in Valley Falls, Ontario. I suspect that drinking songs were considered disreputable back at the point when their collection was starting and that they just wouldn't include them, because I think they had a number of temperance songs. But anyway. Of course, alcohol could also be purchased in privately owned liquor stores such as this one. There were no government-run liquor stores before 1916. So, by the end of the 19th century, there were bigger and bigger producers, more and more retailers, and a growing population of male wage earners who were enjoying alcoholic pleasures available. Well, I'm sure you will not be surprised, especially out here in Toronto Junction, where I meant to say at the beginning, it's wonderful to be delivering this lecture in a part of the city that probably fought about booze over the last century more than any other part of the city. And we'll come back to why. But it's people in the know in the neighborhood are nodding their heads and understanding because they know how often that battle went on. So everyone was not happy about drinking, and a great debate about alcohol actually broke out across North America, across the Western world in some ways, but particularly in North America. Beginning as far back as the late 1820s, when the first temperance movements appeared. For these people, alcohol was fundamentally evil and dangerous. Initially, they tried to convince people to give up drinking spirits, figuring that wine and beer and cider was okay, it wasn't as bad for you, but within a few years they said, no, this is every single bit of alcohol on your tongue is a slippery slope to perdition, no way can you go near it. All alcoholic beverage had to go. People were urged to adopt teetotal abstinence. In other words, they were to become teetotalers, as a popular phrase became. So they campaigned widely to convince people to sign a pledge not to touch the stuff again. In the 1830s and 40s, thousands of people did, and they kept on doing so for decades, right up to 1876, when Ida Carman signed this one up in Thornhill. They were temperance advocates were committed to a view of living that put great stress on personal control and self-discipline, and they saw alcohol as a major destructive force to that way of being. And in their rhetoric and imagery, like this, which is one of a series of pictures that shows the decline of this family in the early 1850s, they emphasized the responsibility that men had to their homes and families, and they suggested there could be a new and nobler sort of masculinity that happened than the one that happened when men hung out together in taverns. And here he's clearly just degrading the sense of masculinity by bringing home rum, and of course she's getting a taste for it, and it's straight downhill from that. The degradation in the rest of them is quite noticeable. So one of the things they did was to try and create alternative spaces for people, especially men, to spend time. And there were a number of not only temperance tea houses and such like, but coffee shops rather, but a number of fraternal societies that were started, the Sons of Temperance, but a lot of them had the name Templar, the Royal Templars of Temperance and so on. This was a Canadian version. Some of the temperance groups devoted special attention to rescuing drunks and putting them back on the straight and narrow. They were determined to help rather than to condemn. This is a meeting where they're clearly giving food and drink. I think this is probably St. Lawrence Hall, like the last picture that I showed you like this. But these groups tended to be much smaller than the mainstream groups and to have much less impact overall. The problem for these strong believers in a dry society was that society was not getting much drier. So many of them who took the pledge forgot all about it the next morning and quickly fell off the wagon. So what the temperance forces like to call the liquor traffic, the producers and the retailers, were getting bigger and bigger and selling more and more, an ocean of alcohol flowing out to satisfy the Canadian thirst. Consequently, around 1850, the temperance, the teetotalers began to turn their campaign away from trying to convince each individual person to change their behavior to saying we need legislation to ban the production and sale of all alcoholic beverages, both in saloons and in private liquor stores. They got it for a wee while in New Brunswick in 1856, and they came close, surprisingly close, here in the province of Canada at the same point, but that was defeated. But in 1864, they did get a new law in Ontario. It wasn't yet Ontario, it was the province of Canada. It was 3 years away from becoming Ontario. That was called the Duncan Act. It had nothing to do with the donut industry. It was Mr. Duncan. Which allowed local municipalities to hold a referendum on whether or not to ban booze within the boundaries of their own municipality. And that became known as local option. In 1877 in Toronto, there was a huge campaign on Duncan Act referendum. A couple of things to note. One is that there was still open voting at that point in plebiscites in Toronto, which is quite odd, as late as 1877. And secondly, there wasn't one day for it. It went on for days and days and days and days. So this is people fighting to get to or away from the polling booth. People trying to vote by declaring themselves. Cops trying to... This is part of a much bigger picture that was created for Canadian Illustrated News. And so on. And backroom folks trying to plot who should they get out the next day because they didn't have enough people come out that day, and so on. The vote lasted for days. There was fighting in the streets, intimidation of voters, and the wets won. So prohibition didn't happen at that point. But prohibition groups were getting better organized by the 1870s. And got a national law passed known as the Scott Act. And it basically took the local option model and spread it across the country. Municipalities could vote themselves dry. And guess what happened in Toronto Junction in 1903? That's what they did. They voted themselves dry. And stayed that way for almost a century. Well, the 1870s also brought some new force and new energy into the temperance campaign, in the form of a new organization of women, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, WCTU. This is a group that is often the butt of jokes. We like to joke about the old prudes of the WCTU, and wizened up prunes that they were. But in actual fact, they were an earnest, well-meaning group of women who were concerned about the ways that women and children suffered abuse as a result of excessive alcohol consumption. Men drank up their wages and left them to starve. They arrived home drunk and beat them up, and so on. That was the imagery of their campaign. Some writers have even suggested that we should see them as early forms of feminists, because they were so concerned about women and their particular concerns and the plight of women, and in fact were some of the staunchest and earliest supporters of the right of women to vote, because they really didn't believe that men should control the elections and electoral politics. They also helped to form a wonderful new alliance with they knew how to name things back then. The Dominion Alliance for the Total Suppression of the Liquor Traffic. Popularly known as the Dominion Alliance. Well, what I found interesting in trying to figure these people out was to see what kind of propaganda they produced. And the Temperance Campaign spewed out a huge amount of powerful imagery as part of their propaganda, particularly in the form of cartoons and drawings that depicted anyone connected with alcohol sales as dangerous and evil creatures. Some of them emphasized simply an economic argument. Clearly this is a straightforward one. You don't want to vote to keep booze flowing because the brewer is a homebreaker and the poor homemaker is going to lose out. A lot of them are concerned about boys and their growth into masculinity. So here they present, which will you choose? Your bright-eyed boy who stands today for parting of the ways. The temperance used one leads to usefulness, honor, peace, and joy. The other is to indulgence, ruin, sorrow, sin, and shame. Well, you can see the kind of trajectory, you know, by old age, look at the comparison. Actually, it's these middle-aged ones that worry me. And further on, they want to make it quite clear. I actually saw a button at an antique market a couple of weeks ago that had this slogan on that. He wanted much too much money for it, didn't buy it. It was from the Temperance Campaign. Beer or the boy? They also frequently talked about the liquor traffic in terms of serpents and monsters that they took from fairy tales and fables and such like. So here's one of a horrible spider breaking out of the cocoon, out of the egg of the saloon, bribery, vice, crime, bosses and municipal misrule, etc., etc., frauds, boodle. Often a vulture who's wearing the outfit of a saloon keeper, remember the apron? Who's going to swoop down and grab the family. It's corruption, lust, and murder is his nest there. Now this one is a wonderful mix of things. Obviously it's in David and Goliath, but I don't remember in my Sunday school lessons Goliath looking quite like that. This is like an imposition of the worst kind of fairy tale monster into Goliath's garb, and he's got behind him all sorts of forces that are evil, and over here are the forces of good. And of course, we know that the outcome will be that he'll be defeated. Now this is one of my personal favorites. This came out in 1902 before a referendum, and Ontario was trying to convince not quite sure what Ontario is except justice, trying to convince Ontario what to do about the Voter Act. Well, just look at this. Can you imagine many worse things? Madness, drunkenness, the baby lying dead, man about to hatchet his wife, the devil's arm. It's wonderful. And of course, in the First World War, they were convinced that the liquor traffic was in league with the Kaiser and Hindenburg, who were our mortal enemies. Well, the other side didn't respond in kind. They instead put forward a vision of themselves, of their products, in their advertising for their products, as being very good for you and perfectly respectable. So there's a whole series of them. I've just chosen a handful that talk about health. He drinks it for health's sake. It's a wonderful bodybuilder. Cosgrave has made a product. You can almost feel your strength coming back if you enjoy the boss of this rich premium ale. Take it as you prefer. It will do you good any time and all the time. Now, I don't know who Professor Gartner is. I really have tried to find out, but I don't know. But somewhere, however, he is able to be quoted as saying that a quart of beer is equal to food value of bread and meat and so on. Somebody else was quoted in another one that said a glass of beer is a beefsteak in a glass and so on. But bring medical authority in on your side. Also, try and make appeal to working people by telling them if they work so hard they need a nourishing stimulant absolutely necessary to build up the body and so on. But there was also an appeal to gentility and to women. There were a number of ads, I've only chosen one, that show women serving a meal or shopping for booze. To try and suggest, and these are not working class women, these are genteel, upper class or middle class women, and that's clearly a guy come home from work in a shirt and tie, right, who's being served this fine stuff for your dinner or your tea. Well, prohibitionists weren't happy with local option, and they tried repeatedly and unsuccessfully to get a national or a provincial prohibition law to banish the bar. They did manage to get government to regulate the consumption and sale and consumption of alcohols pretty closely. They managed to reduce the number of licenses drastically, so the number of licensed hotels and liquor stores really substantially reduced, and they managed to establish all sorts of conditions like no gambling or card playing, no music, and most importantly, to restrict hours. All of the graduate students in here will be shocked to realize that bars closed at 7 o'clock on Saturday night. And rigidly so. And of course, that simply led to bootleggers opening up at 8 o'clock. More about that in a moment. Not until the First World War did they finally break through and get all the provinces and the federal government to agree that things had to be brought to a halt. And they had to do that by a major campaign of pressure. Here in Ontario, there was a major petition campaign in the latter part of 1915, early part of 1916, that culminated in March 1916 in a huge march through the streets of Toronto on a snowy March day. And this circular, it's a bit hard to make out, this is a great drum, a petition that's been all wrapped up together, being carried to the legislature. This is a half-mile long banner that... The text of which I have somewhere, I couldn't find it this week, but I know I have it buried somewhere, that makes some great long message. partway along, the soldiers broke, who didn't like these guys at all, broke through and started tearing this up. But nonetheless, they got to the steps of the legislature, met Premier Hearst, presented the petition, and he basically had orchestrated this. He wanted some public support for what he was going to do anyway. And he passed, he brought legislation into the fall. The wartime atmosphere created a sense that you couldn't allow the kind of self-indulgence that alcohol was associated with. That it was a time when restraint was necessary, national efficiency, and so on. And so for the first time, the temperance forces, the prohibition forces, actually had some momentum behind them, some public values they could attach themselves to. So they turned to governments like Hearst's government and said, stop the liquor traffic for at least for the war. So, like other premiers, he followed through with legislation that resulted in September of 1916 in the closing of all bars, all private clubs, all liquor stores, all traffic in alcohol. And unlike the United States, Canadian prohibition would proceed province by province. There wasn't a national law that governed all of this. It was a very odd constitutional decision that the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council had made many years earlier. I won't go into that in great depth unless somebody wants to know later. But only in 1918 did the federal government play its part by cutting off interprovincial commerce and international commerce till the end of the war. All of this was intended as a wartime measure, or a series of wartime measures, so it was up for grabs once the war was over at the end of 1918. And during 1919 and 1920, there were referenda all across the country on these issues. And Ontario had its own series. In 1919, 1921, and 1923, it held referenda on different versions of what needed to be done. This is from 21, and they're trying to cut off the interprovincial trade. And every time in Ontario that happened, the majority went dry. But that was largely the countryside and the small towns. The cities voted overwhelmingly wet, including Toronto. So in essence, prohibition was imposed on a reluctant, unsupportive urban population that had fought back with its own campaign. The Citizens Liberty League led the campaign and fought back against the notions of liberty and challenge. WCTU again, of course, this is the kind of newspaper ad that they put out, but they lost nonetheless. So the country was legally dry, but there were ways to get drinks. There was a weak beer with a low alcohol content that was offered for sale, known as temperance beer, but it wasn't popular. Anyone who's tried 2% beer would know why. Armed forces still got full-strength beer. This is sometime in 1916, where Canadian troops are getting their daily beer ration. We also know now that before the troops went into battle, they always had rum rations to supposedly just to stiffen their resolve and keep their nerves under control. Most interestingly, from our perspective, at this point there was still a sense that alcohol was a medicine. It was controversial within the medical community, but it was not so controversial that they could ride roughshod over a sense that alcohol as medicine should still be made available. So a doctor could write a prescription for up to a quart of liquor, of spirits, for an individual. Needless to say, the temperance movement quickly thought that this was veiled bootlegging. And in actual fact, just before Christmas every year, there would be such an outbreak of sore throats that there would be lineups out the door from the doctor's office down the street. And in 1923, doctors across the province wrote, get this, 800,000 prescriptions for alcohol. It was a very sick year. Of course, people also brewed their own at home, which was legal, but distilling of spirits wasn't. And so this is a still that was discovered out in the countryside near, in this region, not far from Toronto. Some people not only distilled it for their own use, of course, but sold it to make money. But perhaps most remarkably of all, although prohibition is in place, quote unquote, breweries and distilleries and wineries were allowed to keep producing. Well, who's going to buy it? The export market. Breweries had had almost no export market before this. Distilleries had had some. Who were they going to sell it to? Well, in the United States in 1919, complete prohibition, including the production of alcohol, was shut down by the American government. So there's a very thirsty population in large numbers just across the Detroit River or just over Lake Ontario that had to be serviced. It's also the case that there were a lot of Canadians that would like some of that. So what began to happen was that a lot of this stuff that was intended not to be, of course some of this was supposedly temperance beer. Some of it was, but a lot of it was full strength, just sold out the back door to a bootlegger. But some of it also was loaded in boats on the waterfront in the dead of night and whisked across the lake with no lights on, scurrying across by bootleggers and rum runners. And a network of them quickly developed throughout the across the border and throughout the countryside, right down to your local neighborhood. Every neighborhood had a bootlegger, and you knew where you could go and get the stuff. Also, a lot of places had a little back kitchen where you could come and sit with a few friends. Not great big speakeasies, but small places that were known as blind pigs for some reason. This is not a very clear picture, but it's the only one I could find in a hurry of one of the boats that got caught. This is on Ashbridges Bay in 1923 in one of the speedboats from the lake, and a bunch of cops and reporters and whatnot gathered around. And speedboats were often out there racing against time with police boats, U.S. Coast Guard boats, and so on. A few kingpins in this business did very well. They managed just to divert their money to the most famous, of course, are the Bronfmans, who bought Seagram's. But Harry Hatch was a guy who was really big into this kind of activity, bought up Goodrem & Wirtz and Hiram Walker in Windsor. And of course, none of this underground economy would have survived if there'd been some kind of an effective enforcement of the laws. Sure, just crack down, right? And they did try. There were a bunch of, this is up in Elk Lake, it was one of the best and most frequently shown pictures because there aren't a lot of them around. But the idea was to do it as publicly and ceremonially as possible. This is dumping all the beer that they found in a blind pig in Northern Ontario. But in actual fact, the police forces were understaffed, divided up into three different jurisdictions, they warred with each other, and didn't cooperate, and they were all highly susceptible to bribery. Plus, a lot of them liked to drink themselves and didn't much think much of prohibition. And they soon discovered that thousands of Canadians didn't support the prohibition laws, refused to testify against bootleggers, and regularly used their services. Drinking didn't disappear, but went underground. And in fact, this might well be the greatest example of civil disobedience in Canadian history. These are hunters. Clearly, he doesn't want to have his picture taken, but, you know, there it is. Well, eventually, a lot of Canadians had enough of this farce, this legal farce. Working men resented having lost access to their favorite brew. They also resented the fact that their favorite neighborhood hangout had shut down, the saloon. The super rich had never been keen about prohibition laws, as it turns out. They liked still having access to their claret and their champagne and their brandy and so on, and they really resented having that all cut off and their dinner parties having to go dry. In fact, the stern, upright notion of masculinity and femininity that had been part of the temperance view of the world for nearly a century was breaking down. And many men and women of all classes were turning happily to new identities that were more sensuous and less repressive. Drinking fit into their new interest in dancing, smoking, roller skating, playing baseball, riding roller coasters, a whole variety of new pleasurable activities that were much more expressive and transgressive than the old forms of very prim activity that the temperance movement had been part of. So in the early 1920s, Ontario, like all the other provinces, had a so-called moderation league led by some of the most prominent business and political leaders of the province that mobilized to get plebiscites to end prohibition. It's interesting, however, to emphasize that they were not talking about bringing back the saloon. They didn't say, let's go back to 1916. They were talking about a new kind of moral regulation. This one didn't work, let's try a new one. And the label for that was government control. That is exactly what they called it. A new government policy that would tightly regulate alcohol consumption. The first step was to get everyone looking for booze to buy it from government-owned liquor stores. Ontario opened its chain of these places in 1927, 11 years after Prohibition had been introduced, and on the 1st of June 1927, Toronto came out in droves to get their share of what was available at the new liquor stores. The crowds blocked in. These were sober places that looked more like banks than stores. When I was doing the book and since, I have not been able to find good pictures of LCBO stores. This is the exterior one. I'm not even sure where it is. Could be Toronto, but this is what they looked like. You wouldn't know going by, except for the crests, the coat of arms, that there was anything there. Certainly not like our modern liquor stores. We'll come back to that. Inside, booze was kept behind the counter, out of sight. This is a bit later, so you can actually see it, but customers had to fill out request slips. I remember doing that. There are people in the room who are going to say they remember doing that, and then you younger folk are going to say, what are you talking about? Right? Well, none of us under the age of, I'm not even going to say what, will remember that you also had to have a liquor permit until 1962. This was a little booklet that opened up, and when you came in, you had to present it every time that you bought. And the man behind the counter had to fill in how much you bought, how much it was worth, initial it, date it. So that if you came in three times in 1 week, he'd look up at you and say, Harry, what about the wife and kids? Because in actual fact, these store employees had the right to deny customers their booze if the permit book showed they'd been buying too much recently. They also agreed to take permit books away from people who were on welfare or in otherwise financial difficulty. And if you try and imagine those people that we now see in the liquor stores, who basically are cashiers, having this role of stopping you and saying, now, I don't think so. I really don't think you should have this, right? And some of them must see some regular customers all the time. And unless I know they don't serve drunks that much. But this is quite different from that. This is a very direct kind of social.
What year was this?
This started in 1927 and lasted till the early 1960s. By I think the mid-50s, the date is gone out of my head, it was just a card, it was no longer this book, but up to that point. And also from 34 on, this didn't apply to deer, just for spirits and to hard liquor. But nonetheless, and it cost you $2, as you can just see down at the bottom, every year. You got a new one every year. Like some other provinces, Ontario was much slower. I mean, we got government liquor stores. You can get it. It's wrapped in brown paper. You take it home. That's the model that's being proposed here. Ontario, like other provinces, was much slower about opening up public drinking places. And when they did, in 1934, these were intended to be starkly unpleasant places known as beverage rooms. In other provinces, they were called beer parlors, but here they were beverage rooms. They were intended to be as different from old-time saloons as possible. Drinkers had to be seated. Do you remember those other pictures? Everyone was standing up all the time and leaning on the bar. Here, you had to be sitting in little chairs in clusters of four. You don't want big crowds, just little clusters of four. If you want another drink, you don't go and get it. It has to be brought to you. Notice that this is the only bar that is allowed. It's a service bar. And it's basically in the wall. It's not something that you can actually... There was such a mythology of what the bar meant, that great long piece of mahogany down the middle of the room, ornately carved and so on. Wasn't allowed. Sitting here, you're allowed no food. You can't have any games. You can't play cards. You can't listen to music. You can't sing. All you're supposed to do is sit and drink. Now, there has been more than one commentator who stopped and said, whoever thought that a man is going to drink less when he's sitting, or is going to end up less drunk when he's sitting down while he's drinking and not eating anything? Right? an interesting question. Like the old beverage rooms, these were still overwhelmingly hangouts for working men. And they made them the same kind of gathering places they'd been in the past. Places to get away, relax, hang out with other guys, and all the other things that guys get up to. But there was a new wrinkle. The Hotel Grand Albane, I have to admit, I haven't been along young to check whether there's still anything left of it, but this was a hotel, the corner of Young and Grand Albane. Notice that there's a men's entrance and a ladies' entrance. Something new has been added. Remember those pictures of saloons? There are no women. Ontario, like several other provinces, created separate areas in these hotels that were for women, to be known as ladies and escorts rooms. You could go into it as a single woman, although usually going in by yourself, you would be assumed to be a prostitute and you wouldn't get served. But you could go in with your girlfriends, or you could go in with a man on your arm, maybe even two, but you had a man. The thing was, a man could not go in on his own. This was a place that women had to be escorted or knew that they were going to be safe from the sharks that might be out there trying to get them. So for the first time in living memory, women had a recognized place in public drinking culture in Canada. Temperance advocates were shocked and tried to argue this would destroy motherhood. But advertisers beamed their message at women and lots of them responded. That's even a different kind of image from the earlier ones. Because it's so straightforwardly, they're sitting together over a table, sharing a glass, and she's looking, and we won't even go to what she's got in her eyes. The 1940s saw some major changes in drinking, promoted to a great extent by the war and the prosperity of the period. Drinking was becoming associated with the good life in post-war Canada, and more of the middle class wanted to indulge more freely. But they didn't feel comfortable in those beverage rooms. So governments began to license classier drinking places called cocktail lounges. This was Toronto's first. A beautiful place for those that never saw it. It's unfortunately gone. It should have been saved. But it was quite a wonderful place. People wanted to have the chance to be there in their best Bibb and Tucker in an environment of other people like themselves. This is the Club Norman on Adelaide East. And of course to have access to a much wider range of drinks than the swill that was called beer. The decor was fancier, the drinks were more expensive, you could sit at the bar, men and women could mix freely, and the whiff of sexuality hung in the air. Most of the studies done in the period suggest this, that it was a much more... It was a much more sexualized environment for courtship than the old beverage rooms had been. Indeed, some sites became meeting up points for same-sex relationships, including the famous St. Charles on Yonge Street, which is now, it's all stores along here. But also, entertainment was now possible. For the first time in nearly 100 years, and this had always distinguished us from Europe, where cafes were a major source of entertainment. For the first time in nearly 100 years, finally you could go and find popular music in a drinking place, in taverns. Only in licensed taverns, not in beverage rooms at that point. But by the 1970s, governments had moved even further and liberalized drinking laws to a remarkable extent. They allowed women to serve beer and other drinks. Some of us will remember that they lowered the drinking age, first to 18, and then a few years later they bumped it back up to 19. But I found interesting, this is the Colonial Tavern on Yonge Street. It's also, very controversially, an outdoor drinking area. That was a huge debate in the 1970s, because you didn't want to have to see anybody drinking. When they closed down Yonge Street one summer, this place put a hedge around. And there was a great controversy about whether they should be charged under the liquor laws because people could see over the hedge and see folks like this drinking, including these youngsters. Drinking also got more domesticated. A lot more people were now taking their booze home to drink, even integrating it into their favorite new pastime of watching TV. Booze was no longer seen as the antithesis to the home.
I don't know who she was, but clearly this was a promotional ad for the new stubby beer bottles
that were being developed at that time. By that point, people weren't so completely absorbed in the pleasures of drinking to have forgotten about the dangers. Since the 1940s, groups of people with serious drinking problems had banded together into a new organization known as Alcoholics Anonymous, which had a steady program of mutual support. Whoops.
Yeah.
There it is. Yeah, that's their provincial conference. Which had a steady program of mutual support in overcoming these problems, and of course branches in every neighborhood, very non-bureaucratic, non-professional, very self-help driven organization with a huge membership base. By the 1950s and 60s, some doctors were also convincing governments to put more funding into treatment programs for what the medical community had come to define as the disease of alcoholism. And that helped to sustain the new Addiction Research Foundation, which of course is now part of CAMH. Pretty dark, but anyway. Today, of course, there isn't a lot of faith in a disease theory of alcoholism, but there are many diverse treatment programs run by different agencies. The Addiction Research CAMH still runs a number of them, but there are also those run by different agencies, including those developed explicitly by Aboriginal groups and those developed by unions for their particular memberships. Meanwhile, of course, the policing of drunks had continued with more sophisticated breathalyzer equipment. This is sophisticated in 1957, anyway. Equipment that can even catch future mayoralty candidates. In an effort to reduce the harm that they can cause to others, it says here. Well, wonder whether future mayoralty candidates. Anyway, so we stand at the beginning of the 21st century with a long, complex, and deeply ambivalent history with old John Barleycorn. Today we bring out a bottle to celebrate everything imaginable, at the same time as we worry about the dangers of drunk driving, fetal alcohol syndrome, and date rape. We find many people cutting back their consumption considerably at the same time as many young men spend their weekend evenings consuming gargantuan quantities of alcohol. We have governments funding expensive medical service for treating alcoholic abuse, like that last picture suggested, at the same time as they make millions in revenues from these splashy government-owned liquor stores where they promote consumption on a regular basis. What meal can be prepared without going to their wonderful glossy magazine to find recipes? When the Premier of BC got himself into trouble with drunk driving several years ago, the public outcry about his excessive drinking, it's Gordon Campbell, his excessive drinking was loud and strong, even though hundreds of thousands of Canadians had been doing essentially the same thing over the previous holiday season, just a few weeks or a couple of weeks earlier. Back before the Second World War, this novelty photo from Seagram's caught the flavor of our collective attitudes to booze, which in many ways linger on. We seem to have decided that we can't send John Barleycorn packing, but we should expect him to be quiet about his activities and to stay in the shadows behind the veneer of sober respectability represented by the wife and child. For many people, that isn't a very good trade-off, but it certainly is a typically Canadian compromise. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Craig Herron's talk, All Drink to That, Booze in Hogtown, the second in six lectures of the History Matters lecture series sponsored by the Toronto Public Library. Please check back on activehistory.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the History Matters lecture series.